history, which, of course, she did, with its beautiful white stone and narrow, slitted windows. It looked like a very defendable place, she thought, almost ominously so, like the owners expected an attack at any moment. The carriage had to pass through three more gates and over a moat before they reached the central courtyard, where the driver stopped outside the elegant castle apartments. These were a new, more modern addition, clearly, with peaked roofs and many windows. The whole place seemed like the look-don't-touch kind of home, perfectly manicured, never enjoyed. Jane scanned the dozens of windows for movement, but all was quiet, save the horses loitering in the wide field on the far side of the castle. So, these were the prize horses Lord Dudley bragged about so much. She hopped out of the carriage and walked toward a closed gate to look at them. All the horses were fine creatures, with sleek coats and spindle-thin legs, but the best among them was a beautiful stallion on the other side of the field. His muscles rippled as he thundered across the grass, his head high and ears alert. He thrashed his head so his mane streamed back in the wind, the sun gleaming off his chestnut coat. He was simply magnificent. While, true, her experience with horses was generally limited to the gentle and well-mannered geldings appropriate for a lady, Jane thought she had never seen a horse more worthy of the constant bragging. How amazing it would be, she imagined then, to live as a horse, the ability to run like that, to fly across the ground on those strong, powerful legs, no one nagging her, pinching her, commenting on what a small, insignificant person she was. What she wouldn't give for the ability to change into a horse and escape not just this engagement, but everything that was wrong with her life.
"My lady," came a man's voice from behind her, "may I help you with something?"
Jane turned and craned her neck, first noting that the gentleman who stopped beside her was a well-dressed fellow. Then she finished looking up. There it was, the nose. Truly, it was a great, arching eagle nose that would enter a room 5 whole seconds before the rest of him did. It may help the reader to recall the long-nosed plague doctor mask that would appear in the next several decades. It is said the design of those beaked masks was actually inspired by the Dudley nose, though never within a Dudley heir's hearing. God's teeth! What if this was Gifford?
"I'm here to visit Lord Gifford Dudley," she said hesitantly, catching herself as she addressed the nose.
But it was right over her. It was hard to avoid. She took a measured step backward in hopes she'd be able to meet his eyes.
"Ah," the man smiled knowingly. "You're here to visit my brother."
Phew! This nose, rather, this man wasn't Gifford, but Stan Dudley, the older brother who sometimes accompanied his father to court. Not that Jane paid much attention at court, she had so many books to read. But what if Gifford's nose was worse? She clutched her books to her stomach and considered prayer. Would praying for a decent-sized nose be considered sacrilege?
"Yes, I'd like to see Gifford now."
"I'm afraid he's unavailable. He's, busy with the horses."
Stan glanced at the pasture, but if Gifford was out there, Jane couldn't see him. The only creatures were the horses, who'd moved to a new spot of grass.
"He won't receive me?"
"Not right now."
This was infuriating. She wanted to at least lay eyes upon her intended before they were to be wed. Was that so much to ask? Stan turned his head, momentarily blocking the sun with his nose.
"I see you're upset. I'm terribly sorry, but you know my brother never has time for ladies until after dark."
"Ladies? Plural?" Sir Nose went on.
You must be Anne, Frederica, Jeanette.
Jane blinked at him. I'm sorry, who? Stan crossed his arms and inspected her more closely.
Red hair. That is unusual. I can't recall my brother mentioning one of his ladies was a redhead.
One of his ladies? She managed to squeak.
Surely you didn't think you were the only one. But I'd thought he usually preferred brunettes, taller, with more shape.
Jane gasped. This was outrageous. Who did this Stan fellow think he was? Why, Jane was of royal blood. Her great-grandmother was a queen, after all, cousin and friend to Edward the Sixth. She had the king's ear, and it would not be long until that royal oracle heard all about the rude, impolite, presumptuous, rotten man.
She was saying none of this out loud, she realized. Instead, she was standing there, slack-jawed, while the mouth beneath the Dudley nose continued to guess her name. There were so many names, at least one for every letter of the alphabet. Did Gifford have relations with all of these women, or was Stan simply being mean?
All right, Stan said. I give up. I'll tell him you came by if you tell me who you are.
She mustered the strongest tone she could.
I am Lady Jane Grey. His fiancée!
Stan went still for a moment, and then hurried into a bow.
Oh, I see, my lady. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize. I should never have said all those things. It's just you have such red hair for a highborn. I mean, I would never have mentioned the other ladies, because there are no other ladies anywhere in the world except my wife and you. Gifford will be a faithful and loyal husband to you, like a dog. Well, not like a dog, he sighed. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said anything.
Jane just glared at him. Well, at his nose, it was hard to see much else.
Please accept my sincerest apologies, my lady.
Stan Dudley made several feeble attempts at reparation, mumbled something about leaving her to her thoughts, which were surely as pure as the whitest blossoms on the most virginal tree, and then he was gone. So, her husband-to-be was a philanderer, a smooth operator, a debaucher, a rake, a frisker. Jane became something of a walking thesaurus when she was upset, a side effect of too much reading. No wonder no one had seen him, since the libertine was too busy with the horses during the day, allegedly, and too busy with the strumpets at night. This was not acceptable. Jane stomped back to her carriage. She imagined all the things she would say to Gifford, Edward, her mother, and whoever else had arranged this marriage for her. Angry, angry things. She'd thought this engagement would ruin Gifford's life, but for the first time in perhaps ever, she'd been wrong. The engagement to Lord Gifford Dudley would ruin her life. Unless she put a stop to it. Jane straightened her spine. She was not going to marry Gifford Dudley. And what kind of name was Gifford Dudley, anyway? Honestly, not Saturday, not ever. 3. Gifford. Call him G. The worst part about waking up when the sun went down was the distinct grassy taste of hay in his mouth. An unfortunate side effect of actually having hay in his mouth. But the affliction of unwanted hay-in-the-mouth-itis, or hay-mouth, as his mother referred to it like someone else would refer to morning breath, was not to be avoided when one ended each day as an undomesticated horse and began each night as an undomesticated man. Almost man, his mother would say. At 19 years of age, he was almost a man, definitely undomesticated. As he pushed himself into a crouching position and then into a standing position, G, please call him G and avoid referring to him by his terrible given name, Gifford Dudley the Second, and therefore insignificant son of Lord John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland, stretched out his haunches, which were now hips. He reflected on this morning's jaunt across the countryside. He'd gone northwest this time, running at a flat-out canter over green hills and lush forests for hours before he had to search for water. There was nothing he imagined that could compete with the feeling of a life without boundaries or borders, and the wind running through his hair. Maine. He hadn't asked for this power. If he had, he definitely would have requested the ability to control it as well, even though it would be rather missing the point for a curse to come with an on-off switch. Still, there was an upside to it. He belonged to no one who would want a half-horse, half-man. He could pick a spot on a map and then go there the next time the sun was up, provided his horse brain remembered the way. G would argue that horses were not known for their sense of direction, instead of the likelihood that he, even as a man, could get lost in his own closet. Best of all, he had no humanish responsibilities. After the freedom he enjoyed during his days, nightfall was usually a bit of a letdown. G searched out the pail of water his servant always left for him in the corner, and once he spotted it, he galloped over, in a human way, but probably resembling a horse more than any other human could, and ladled a cupful of water into his mouth. The transformation always left him dehydrated, and tonight he needed his wits about him. Due to an entirely night-time existence, there were only so many activities in which the human G could participate. With the casual, often brash way G spoke, and his general rambunctious demeanour, it was easy for his parents to assume he spent his human hours in the boudoirs of questionable ladies, or getting tipsy in brothels. Lady Dudley was often overheard lamenting, "That boy and his dalliances! What are we to do?" G let them believe that. In fact, he often boasted of his conquests with different ladies in order to play along. If they thought he was something of a Casanova, although they, of course, couldn't equate him with the literal Casanova, who wouldn't be born for another 200 years, it left G the freedom to do as he pleased. Besides, the truth of how he spent his nights was far more humiliating. He would rather his parents believed he was carousing with the ladies. A sharp knock sounded on the stable door. "My lord," Billingsley called from the other side. "Yes," G said, trying to shake the whinny out of his voice like someone else would clear his throat in the morning. "Your trousers." The stable door opened just wide enough for an arm covered in the blue of the steward uniform to extend through, holding a pair of trousers.
"Thank you, Billingsley."
G took the pants and stepped into them as Billingsley set the rest of his clothes on a wooden table so the hay wouldn't besmirch the young lord's ensemble.
"And, my lord, your father would like a word with you when you are appropriately attired."
"My father?" G said, alarmed. "He's returned to the castle?"
"Yes, my lord,"
Billingsley said. G fastened the buttons on the front of his jacket and pulled on his tall leather boots.
"Please tell my father I am otherwise occupied. I have plans."
Billingsley cleared his throat.
"I'm afraid, my lord, your father was rather insistent. You'll have to reschedule your,
Billingsley?" G cut off his servant as the heat rose in his cheeks.
"I thought we had an agreement that we would never mention the thing outside of the place."
"I'm sorry, my lord, but I couldn't recall your requested code word for it."
G closed his eyes and sighed. Billingsley had only recently discovered the true nature of G's secret night outings and had been convinced, cough, bribed, not to tell G's parents.
Dalliances, Billingsley.
My dalliances.
Right, my lord. Your dalliances will have to wait, because your mother requests your company as well. She's with your father in the drawing-room.
His father and his mother both here at the estate in the same room and summoning him? This sounded rather serious.
Yes, his father occasionally requested G's company to discuss his future, his equestrian curse, his inheritance, or lack thereof, considering he was the second son, his desire for more comfortable hoofwear and a blacksmith who could keep his mouth shut. But his mother rarely participated in these discussions. She was more at ease in a nurturing role, like giving him sartorial advice or fixing his hair, or mane, depending on the position of the sun in the sky. G looked at Billingsley.
It's not Christmas, is it?
It's May, my lord.
Somebody's birthday?
No, my lord.
Somebody died?
For a moment he let himself believe it might have been his perfect older brother Stan who had died, leaving behind his perfect wife and their perfect son, but then he realized Stan never made mistakes, and leaving behind a family due to an untimely death would most certainly be considered bad form. In addition, then G would be responsible for marrying and heiring. He shuddered at the thought.
"Not that I am aware of, my lord,"
answered Billingsley. G pressed his noble lips together and blew, a sound that was all hoarse.
"Shall I translate that to mean you are in compliance?"
G closed his eyes.
"Yes."
"Very good, my lord."
What G wouldn't give at this moment to be able to change into a horse at will? Then he could put 50 miles between himself and his father's nose. He would probably need 49 of those miles just to get out from under the sniffer. Twilight transformed into deep dusk as G made the trek up from the stables to the side door of the apartments. His mind was galloping at breakneck speed, wondering what his parents wanted to speak to him about. From the time he was old enough to sit at the supper table, he'd been aware of his inferior position in the family. Stan always got served before G, the main course and all the side dishes. When their father introduced the two of them, it was always,
"This is Stan, the next Duke of Northumberland, heir to the Dudley fortune."
Long pause. "Oh, and this is my other son, Stan's brother." Here your narrators will point out two facts that may have contributed to the Duke of Northumberland's embarrassment surrounding his second son. One, the Ethian power was widely considered to be hereditary, and neither the Duke nor his supposedly devoted wife had the magic. Two, the Duke had an epic nose, the proportions of which were legendary. Gifford's nose was the perfect size, and the shape could have been the inspiration of sonnets. The combination of these two details made the Duke often glance sideways toward his wife and repeatedly treat Gifford as if he wasn't there. That was why, at the age of 13, Gifford had requested his name be reduced to just G, since nobody seemed to care what his name was anyway. Billingsley led G from the side entrance down the third main hall, where G caught a glimpse of himself in a hanging mirror and paused to fish a stray piece of hay out of his chestnut-coloured hair. His mother had strict rules of civility inside the castle, the most important of which was,
"All signs of equestrian escapades are to be left in the stable where they belong."
His mother had always approached his curse as if G wanted to spend his days as a quadruped, as if it were just another way for a privileged teenage boy to rebel, She often forgot that he didn't ask for this curse, and that if he could find a way to control it, he would give Billingsley's right arm for that information. As if he could hear G's thoughts, Billingsley pulled his right arm in front of his body and away from G's line of sight. "In here, my lord," he said as he swung open the doors of the drawing-room using his left arm. Inside the room, his father sat behind an ornate wooden desk, his mother, Gertrude, standing behind him. Her hand rested on Lord Dudley's shoulder as if they were posing for a portrait. His little sister, Temperance, was on the couch, playing with her knights and ladies doll set.
"Giffy,"
she said when she saw him enter the room. Tempy was the only one in the world who could get away with calling him Giffy. "Hi, Curly," G answered, for Tempy had the curliest blonde tresses in all of England. "Oh, son," Lord Dudley said. He motioned to a woman standing in the corner, Tempy's nurse, who immediately took hold of the little girl's hand and led her from the room. Tempy waved awkwardly as she balanced her dolls and held her nurse's hand. "Thank you for joining us with such haste." "Father," G answered with a slight bow of his head, although now he knew something must be wrong, because joining with haste was the best compliment his father had given him in 2 years. His previous compliment had been in recognition of keeping to the background when Rafael Amador, the emissary from Spain, was visiting. "We have some excellent tidings for you," his father continued. Gertrude stood a little taller at this. "And for your future happiness." Uh-oh, thought G. Future happiness was always code for "you have grown into a fine young man and a stout, stallion," his father said. "We may not have a handle on controlling the equestrian situation, but this minor daily divergence from humanity does not preclude you from leading a relatively normal life, nor will it strip you of the rights and privileges afforded any nobleman." First of all, G was annoyed that neither of his parents could tell it like it was and use the phrase horse curse instead of referring to it as his equestrian condition or a minor daily divergence from humanity or some such nonsense. But the more worrisome part of his father's speech was the bit about the rights and privileges afforded any nobleman, because this could only mean marriage, son. Lord Dudley said, "marriage to a well-vetted and, as far as can be anticipated without being tested, fertile young lady of excellent lineage and equally verifiable family connections." G's worst fears come true. "Wow, father, fertile and well-vetted? You make it sound so very romantic." At this point, Lady Gertrude moved her hand from her husband's shoulder and placed it on the back of his neck, as if to prove a showing of such ardent affection was indeed possible in forced marriages.
"Darling boy, if left to your own devices, I fear you would never marry."
"I thought that fact was already established and agreed upon," G said. A month after he'd first begun to turn into a horse, he'd overheard his mother lament to his father that no self-respecting lady would want a half-horse for a husband, and then his father had said his chances would have been better had he been a horse both day and night and skipped the human part entirely. Then perhaps his parents could sell him and receive some compensation for all their trouble. She had gone out and slept in the barn after that. Now in the drawing-room, Lord Dudley shook off his wife's hand as if he were shooing away a pesky insect. "It is my wish for all of my children to marry."
"Why? You don't need heirs from me," G said. "I'm second son."
which is why I have invested the last fortnight securing your happiness.
You mean arranging for me to wed a perfect stranger? G interjected.
Well, thanks but no thanks, Father.
A vein G had never noticed before popped out on Lord Dudley's forehead.
I am securing your happiness and thus ensuring your future and your own estate and a fortune for future generations of Dudley men, and you will get married and father a son or two or seven before you turn into a horse forever. Is that understood?
G backed up a step, partly to avoid Lord Dudley's increasingly airborne spittle, and partly because he did not know turning into a horse forever was even a possibility. Although he had to admit the freedom of galloping far away and blending in with the wild horses of the Cornwall region sounded tempting when compared to impending nuptials. It wasn't like he wanted to spend the rest of his life alone. Marriage had its merits, he supposed, but what kind of husband could he make? His parents' own marriage had taught him that when there is no great love in the beginning, better acquaintance would only lead to more contempt. Besides, what woman would marry him once she found out the truth?
But, Father, you're getting married, or I'll have you gelded, so help me, I will,
Lord Dudley ground out.
And what is the name of my dearly intended?
G asked. This response seemed to calm Lord Dudley a degree.
Lady Jane Grey.
Lady Jane Grey?
G hoped he had heard his father wrong. He hadn't been present in court for several years now, but he knew of Jane. Her reputation preceded her. The book girl.
Lady Jane Grey, daughter of Lady Frances Brandon Grey, first cousin once removed to King Edward.
Lady Gertrude leaned forward.
What do you think, my boy?
G took a deep breath in and exhaled slowly.
I'm thinking lots of things. Like the fact that the lady's face has rarely been seen because it's usually buried in a book.
You've never opposed the education of a lady before,
his mother said,
and I am still not opposed to it. But what if she is merely using the second volume of the Political History of England to cover up some hideous malformation on her face?
Gifford,
his father said. G's mouth snapped shut at the sound of his given name.
Your sharp wit will get you nowhere.
Lord Dudley flared his nostrils and exhaled, a move that nearly produced a windstorm.
My boy, it sounds as if you are under the delusion that this match is merely a suggestion.
His lips disappeared into his beard as they did when Lord Dudley was upset.
Believe me when I tell you the negotiations behind this match have been arduous and delicate, and your romantic notions of lifelong bachelorhood will not be humoured.
He stood and put his fists knuckle down on the desk, the top of his head reaching the mouth of the stuffed bear carcass hanging on the wall, caught in mid-roar.
Let me repeat. You will marry the Lady Jane Grey!
His voice echoed off the walls. Nobody moved for fear of disturbing the beast further. Lord Dudley unclenched his fists and walked over to G.
Congratulations on your upcoming nuptials, son. I'm sure you will be very happy.
Thank you, Father.
G said through clenched teeth.
One last thing. Does Lady Jane know about the equestrian situation?
G couldn't believe he'd resorted to using a phrase his father would use, as if the upcoming marriage had suddenly made him more ashamed of his curse.
Lord Dudley put his arm around his son, but it was only so he could escort him from the room.
It matters not.
he said, and closed the door in G's face.
It matters not.
What was that supposed to mean? That she knew about it and it was of no concern to her, or she didn't know and it wouldn't matter just as long as she repeated her vows before sunup? Billingsley met G near the side entrance of the great estate.
Your overcoat, my lord. I have your horse waiting to take you to your dalliances.
G rolled his eyes. Every time Billingsley used the code word dalliances, it sounded so suspicious. Maybe he should have come up with a different word. And yet, dalliances had a certain cadence to it. If he thought about it hard enough, he was sure he could incorporate it into his performance tonight.
Dalliances. Dalliances. What rhymed with dalliances?
G concentrated as he put his left foot into the stirrup and hoisted himself onto the back of his horse, Westley.
Valiances? Valances?
He was lost inside his own head, searching for rhymes, when Stan passed him on his way down the road from the castle.
Brother, Stan said by way of greeting.
When G had asked Stan to call him G instead of Gifford, Stan had resorted to calling him the even more generic brother.
Good evening, Stan, G said.
Where are you off to?
G's heart rate increased. His brother was rarely curious about G's comings and goings. Maybe Stan knew about the wedding, which would give G more consequence in Stan's mind, or maybe he was just making small talk. Either way, the scrutiny wasn't welcome.
I'm off to... Dalliant. Stan tilted his head. To do the... Dalliant. To be dalliant.
God's teeth, he'd never really investigated how to use the word, and the only times he'd heard it uttered were in the form of one or both of his parents saying something like, "There he goes again, that boy and his many dalliances."
"I have plans," G said, "that may or may not involve dalliancing."
Stan nodded.
Perhaps it will be a red-headed girl this time, a short one, with brown eyes. Would you fancy a girl like that?
I'm not generally picky, G answered cautiously. It's just a dalliance, after all.
Right. Well, carry on.
Thank you, G said. Good night, Stan.
He put his head down and urged his horse into a smooth canter. At this point, he could not afford any more distractions or impediments. He held his lantern as steady as he could, but he didn't need much light for this journey. It was simply a turn to the right, then to the left, then two rights, then a slight right, then a hairpin left, then up the hill, then over the bridge, then a sharp left, and you were there. G could have done it with his eyes closed. By the time G tied his horse outside the Shark's Fin Inn, the moon was high. He could already hear the raucous crowd inside, cheering and hissing and shouting oaths and clanging goblets. He checked in with the barkeep, signing his name as John Billingsley, and then took a stool at a table with four other men who had clearly already downed multiple flagons of ale.
"Back again for more, are you?" said the man with the bushiest beard.
G ignored him and placed his hand over his vest pocket, feeling for his latest work, the ecstasy of eating greenery. Then he reached down and felt for the dagger at his hip. Public poetry readings were known to be a rough business, especially when presenting new material. A man could lose a lot more than just his pride.
4. Edward. When you were dying, Edward quickly discovered, people would let you do pretty much whatever you wanted. So he made some new unofficial decrees. 1. The king was allowed to sleep in as long as he wished. 2. The king no longer had to wear 7 layers of elaborate jewel-encrusted clothing,
or silly hats with feathers, or pants that resembled pumpkins, or tights. From now on, unless it was a special occasion, he was fine in just a simple shirt and trousers. 3. Dessert was to be served first. Blackberry pie, preferably, with whipped cream. 4. The king would no longer be taking part in any more dreary studies. His fine tutors had filled his head with enough history, politics, and philosophy to last him 2 lifetimes, and as he was unlikely to get even half of 1 lifetime, there was no more need for study. No more lessons, he decided. No more books. No more tutors' dirty looks. 5. The king was now going to reside in the top of the southeast turret, where he could sit in the window ledge and gaze out at the river for as long as he liked. 6. No one at court would be allowed to say the following words or phrases. Affliction, illness, malady, sickness, disease, disorder, ailment, infirmity, convalescence, indisposition, malaise, plight, plague, poor health, failing health, what's going around, or your condition. Most of all, no one was allowed to say the word dying. And finally, and perhaps most importantly for the sake of our story, 7. Dogs would now be allowed inside the palace. More specifically, his dog. Edward had always loved dogs. Dogs were uncomplicated. They loved you without expectation. They were devoted and loyal, not because you were the king and you could have their heads chopped off if they displeased you, but because it was in their nature to be so. Most of the time, he greatly preferred the company of dogs to the company of men. Edward's favourite dog was named Pet, short for Petunia. She was the best kind of dog, a large Afghan hound with flowing wheat-coloured hair and long, silky ears. Pet was warm and soft and goofy and always good for a laugh. And so, for the past few days, simply because Edward said so, Pet had been allowed in the throne room, the dining hall, the council chambers, and his newly arranged bedchamber in the turret. Wherever the king went, so too went Pet. His sister Mary, for the record, did not approve of dogs in the castle. It was undignified. It was unsanitary. Bess was allergic. Plus, she was more of a cat person. But neither one of them could really protest because their brother was dying, and how does one deny the wishes of a dying king? So it was that on Friday morning, after breakfasting on blackberry pie and whipped cream, Edward was lounging on the throne in a shirt and pants, not even wearing his crown, with Pet's head resting on his lap. He was scratching behind one of her silky ears, and Pet's hind leg was moving in time to his scratching because she couldn't help herself. Mary was in the corner, muttering something about fleas. Bess was sniffling into a handkerchief. Lord Dudley, having just returned from his trip to his country estate to fetch his son, was sitting in a much smaller chair on Edward's right, reading over some official-looking document, a pair of spectacles, or the early predecessor of what we think of as spectacles, perched on the landscape of his nose. That's when Edward heard the indignant footfalls ringing on the stone in the outer corridor and the familiar, high-pitched voice demanding, "No, I must speak with the king now, please." But before the steward even had a chance to announce, "Lady Jane Grey, Your Majesty," which was protocol when someone was about to enter the king's presence, the doors to the throne room burst open and in rushed Jane. It was Friday, as we mentioned. If all went according to Lord Dudley's plans, Jane and his son Gifford would be tying the knot tomorrow night. Edward smiled, happy to see her. He hadn't seen much of her lately on account of his illness, but she was just as he always pictured her, albeit a little travel-worn. Jane, however, did not seem happy to see him. There were 2 bright pink spots in the middle of her cheeks and wisps of her ginger hair sticking to her sweat-dampened face, as if she'd run all the way from Bradgate, and she was frowning. "Hello, cousin," Edward said.
you're looking well. Why don't you sit down and have a nice cup of tea?
He was going to offer, because he was English and that's what the English do under stress. They drink tea.
No tea! Jane interrupted, waving away the royal tea mistress, who was approaching her with a teapot in one hand and a saucer and teacup in the other. I need to talk to you, Edward. It's urgent.
The throne room, which was full of courtiers, fell silent for a few seconds, and then broke out into a rumble of scandalized murmurs, although whether the lords and ladies present were more scandalized by Jane's casual use of Edward's first name or her very rude refusal of his offer of tea, we can't say. Lord Dudley cleared his throat.
All right,
Edward said a bit nervously. Jane's gaze darted around the throne room as if she had just noticed that she had an audience. Her face reddened even more.
I need to speak with you about, the reign of King Edward Plantagenet II. I've been reading this very important book about that period of English history, and I wanted your opinion on the subject.
Alone, her eyes said, now. Concerning the wedding, of course. Edward was quiet for a moment, trying to figure out how best to handle the logistics of seeing Jane in private.
"It is of great historical importance,"
Jane insisted.
"Ah, yes," Edward stammered. "Very well. I would be delighted to talk to you about the reign of King Edward Plantagenet,"
Jane provided.
"The first, the second,"
she corrected.
"Yes, of course. Why don't we go for a walk, and you can tell me all about it?"
Jane's small shoulders sagged in relief.
Thank you.
Edward stood up. His eyes met Dudley's. The Duke looked decidedly disapproving, but Edward ignored him.
I'm going to walk with Lady Jane in the orchard, Edward announced. Carry on without me.
But Your Majesty, protested Mistress Penn, rushing forward. She was his nursemaid, a plump, kind-faced old woman who had looked after him when he was a baby and been called back to his side during his illness earlier in the year. Lately she was always hovering, fretting that he wasn't dressed warmly enough, worrying that any small exertion might be too much of a strain on his now delicate constitution.
Are you sure that's wise in your condition?
That was one of the forbidden words, but Edward decided he would allow it from Mistress Penn, because when he'd get his fevers she'd sit next to his bed and put a cool cloth on his forehead and stroke his hair and sometimes even sing to him.
Yes, sir, perhaps you should rest,
agreed Dudley. Edward waved them off.
What's the worst that could happen? I could catch my death.
He was trying to be brave and jovial in the face of it all, but in this he obviously failed. Dudley looked disappointed in him. Mary appeared more solemn than usual. Mistress Penn put her hand over her wrinkled mouth and shuffled away, sniffling.
Brilliant, he thought. Just brilliant.
But should dying people have to apologize? Jane looked at him, suddenly taking in his plain clothes and lack of crown and the wag-tailed dog at his side.
"Edward, what's going on?"
she asked. "Come," he said, stepping down from the throne and offering Jane his arm.
"Let's get out of here."
And so they walked, dog and girl and king, out of the palace and across the grounds and down through the entire length of the orchard, where they settled under the white blossoms of an apple tree.
All right,
he said, once they were certainly out of earshot of anyone from court.
What's the matter, Janey?
I can't get married tomorrow, she burst out. You've got to call it off.
But why?
Edward picked up his scratching of behind Pet's ears, and she made a happy dog noise deep in her throat.
I simply cannot marry him, that's all. Not him.
But I hear he's a fine young man, Jane,
Edward said. Lord Dudley assured me that Gifford will be a model husband. When he wasn't busy galloping around the countryside, Edward thought a tad guiltily. Jane picked at the brocade on her gown.
That's what they all say, isn't it? A fine young man, a good match. How fortunate I am, indeed.
Well,
I went to Dudley Castle a few days ago, for I thought I might get a chance to see him or speak with him before we're to be wed, and...
Ah, so she must have seen Gifford in his steed-like state, which must have been rather a shock if nobody had told her that Gifford was an Ethian beforehand. What happened? He asked.
It was awful. It turns out Gifford Dudley is a... He's a...
She couldn't even finish the word.
"Please, Edward," she said, and to his horror her voice wavered and broke. "You don't understand. He's a ho-"
"I know," he said. She stared at him.
"You know?"
"Yes, Lord Dudley told me."
"But then why did you agree to the match?" she cried indignantly. "How could you wish me to marry such a—"
"I didn't think you'd mind," Edward said. Her brown eyes widened.
"What?"
"I thought you'd be intrigued by his condition."
"No, I can assure you I am not intrigued by anything to do with him." Jane's nose wrinkled up in distaste. "And I wouldn't exactly say he has a condition."
"Then what would you say?"
Edward was starting to feel as though he'd missed something.
"He's a horrible skirt chaser," she exclaimed. "A stud, a lady killer, a womanizer."
Oh, so she didn't know about Gifford's steed-like state.
"Well, Janie," he said with a cough, "that's hardly surprising, is it? They say he's handsome."
"Do they?" she said with an edge of hysteria. "Do they say that?"
"Yes," Edward affirmed. "And rich, handsome young men with titles can generally have their pick of the ladies."
"Unless you were a teenage king with a coughing problem." Jane's mouth pursed.
"I can't marry him. Please, Edward, you must put a stop to it."
Edward couldn't stop this wedding, he knew, not in his country's present political climate. But he sensed that if he explained the true reason for her rushed nuptials, that they were in a great hurry for her to produce an heir who would inherit the throne of England after he died, it would only upset her further. Instead, he tried to think of something soothing to tell her, but nothing especially soothing came to mind.
"I'm sorry, Jane," he tried. "I can't.
If you care for me at all," she said then, "you won't force me to marry him."
Edward experienced a tightness in his chest. He coughed into his handkerchief until purple spots appeared on the edges of his vision. Pet raised her head from his lap and cast an accusatory glare in Jane's direction.
"Are you all right?"
Jane murmured.
"Edward, are you ill?"
"I'm dying," he confessed. He watched the colour drain from her face.
"I thought it was only a chest cold," she murmured.
"No."
"Not the affliction?"
she guessed, and closed her eyes when he just gazed at her sadly.
"I do intend to get a second opinion," he said, "a better one."
"When?"
she asked in a small voice.
"When do they think?"
"Soon enough."
He took her small, ink-stained hand in his.
"I know this marriage is not what you want. Believe me, I understand. Remember when I was engaged to Mary, Queen of Scots?"
He shuddered.
"But you have to marry somebody, Janie, because that's what young ladies of high birth do. They get married. You can't hide in your books forever."
Jane bent her head. A lock of runaway red hair fell into her face.
"I know. But why him?"
she asked.
"Why now?"
"Because I trust Lord Dudley," he said simply. "And because I'm out of time. I need to know that you'll be taken care of. After I'm gone, who knows who you'd be matched to? There are worse fates than ending up with someone young and good-looking and rich."
"I suppose," she said.
He knew he should tell her about the horse thing. This was a detail she should be aware of. but he couldn't find the appropriate wording for what was essentially, and by the way, the guy you're marrying actually is a stud, literally. He should tell her. He'd get somebody else to tell her.
"Do this for me, Jane," he said gently. "Please. I'm asking as your king, but also as your friend."
She remained silent, staring down at their clasped hands. But something changed in her expression. He saw there the beginnings of acceptance. His chest felt tight again.
"All will be well. You'll see."
He squeezed her hand.
"And if it will make you feel better, I'll speak to this Gifford fellow about his carousing problem. I'll make him swear to be a picture of fidelity. I'll threaten him with the rack or something."
She looked up.
"You could do that?"
He smirked.
"I'm the king. Anything else you'd like me to do to him? The stocks? The cat o' nine tails? Thumbscrews? The Spanish tickler?"
He was relieved to see the hint of a smile that played across her lips.
"Well,"
she said thoughtfully, sliding her hand from his to bury her fingers in the fur at Pet's scruff.
"He might be in need of a good foot roasting."
"Done," he agreed. She let out a little sigh.
"I suppose there is one other thing you can do for me, cousin,"
she said after a moment.
"Whatever you desire," he said, "name it."
Her warm brown eyes met his.
"Walk me down the aisle?"
His heart squeezed again.
"Of course," he said. "It would be my pleasure."
After he'd seen her off in a carriage back to Chelsea, where the Grey family stayed while they were in London, Edward sought out Lord Dudley, who he found in the council chambers, engaged in what appeared to be a very serious conversation with Mistress Penn, on the subject of his failing health, no doubt.
"So," the Duke said as Edward drew near, "did you persuade her?"
Mistress Penn felt his forehead with the back of her hand. At his side, Pet let out a low growl, and the nurse withdrew her hand. "I'm fine," he said. The nurse gave him a look that conveyed that she was still offended by his earlier flippancy, and retreated with a rustle of skirts. He watched the door swing closed behind her. Then he dropped into his red cushy chair and reached for the bowl of blackberries.
"Sire," Lord Dudley began, "you must take care to—"
Pet stuck her long nose into the blackberries and snuffed, sending the bowl clattering to the floor and berries rolling in every direction. Edward gave the dog a stern look as servants rushed in to clean up the mess.
"Bad dog," he said.
She wagged her tail.
"Sire, you mustn't overexert yourself,"
Dudley said.
"I'm fine," Edward insisted. "The fresh air did me good. And, yes, Jane has agreed to marry your son. But why did no one tell her about the horse situation?"
Dudley shook his head as if the issue was entirely unimportant.
"I've found that women do not need to be burdened with such minor details." "Well, that makes sense," thought Edward. "Even so, I'd like to speak with your son."
Dudley's mouth disappeared into his beard.
"My son Gifford?"
he asked, as if he hoped Edward might inexplicably need to parley with Stan.
"Yes, send for him immediately."
"I'm afraid that's impossible, Your Highness."
Dudley gestured to the window, where sunlight was streaming in from the west. There were still hours before sunset.
"Oh, right," Edward said. "Well, as soon as night falls, then."
Dudley still looked uncomfortable.
"But, sire, there are so many preparations that need to be made before tomorrow's ceremony. It will be difficult to get my son away from—" "I desire to speak with him," Edward said in his "I am the king" voice. "I will speak with him tonight."
"Yes, Your Majesty,"
Dudley conceded, "as soon as the sun is down."
Suddenly Edward was tired, so very tired. He sagged against the back of his chair. Pet whined and licked at his hand.
"Are you all right, Your Highness?"
Dudley asked.
"I am fine."
Edward straightened. "I'll be in my chambers," he said, although he had no idea how he was going to manage the stairs. "Send Gifford there when he arrives."
"Yes, sire,"
the Duke said tightly, and then he left Edward to catch his breath. It was less than an hour past sunset when, as expected, there came a knock on the door to Edward's room. Pet started barking, but stopped immediately when Gifford Dudley stepped inside. The two boys stood examining each other. Gifford was predictably tall, broad of shoulder, and boorishly square of jaw. He was as comely as his father had described him, and for a moment Edward actually hated him for looking so decidedly strong and able-bodied. But then Gifford dropped into a bow, and Edward remembered he was king.
"You sent for me, sire?"
Gifford murmured.
"Yes, please sit down."
They both sat awkwardly.
"I wish to discuss Jane."
"Jane?" Edward couldn't tell if Gifford meant this as a statement or a question, or if he even knew who Edward was referring to.
"Your future wife?"
Gifford nodded and scratched at the side of his neck, bearing an expression very similar to one that Jane had been wearing earlier today, the staring into the face of doom look.
"Jane is a very special person to me," Edward began.
"She is..." There really wasn't a good enough word to describe Jane.
"I have yet to meet her," said Gifford delicately, "but I'm sure she's very... special."
"She is." Edward sat forward in his chair.
"What troubles me, Gifford, please? Call me G,"
Gifford interjected. Edward frowned.
"What troubles me, G... is that you haven't been at court these past years, and while I understand why..."
He cast Gifford a significant look that said, "I know all about the horse thing."
"And I know your family to be perfectly respectable and worthy of someone as special as my cousin Jane. I feel that I don't know you."
Then he stopped talking for a minute because Pet, with her tail wagging, had plopped herself right down next to Gifford's chair. Gifford's, not Edward's, mind you, and was staring up at the young lord adoringly. Gifford smiled down on her and reached out to scratch what Edward knew was just the right place behind Pet's chin. She sighed and put her head in his lap. Even she couldn't resist this fellow's charms. Edward started coughing and then coughing and then coughing some more, so hard that his eyes watered. When the spasms subsided, both Pet and Gifford were looking at him with concern.
"Anyway,"
Edward wheezed,
"I want to know, G, that as her husband you will take care of my dear cousin."
"Of course," Gifford said quickly.
"No,"
Edward clarified.
"I mean that there will be no one else that you're going to take care of, ever. Only Jane."
Comprehension dawned in Gifford's eyes.
"Jane deserves a devoted and virtuous husband," Edward continued. "So you will be a devoted and virtuous husband. If I hear even a whisper of anything otherwise, I will be very unhappy. And you would not like to see me unhappy."
Gifford looked decidedly alarmed, which pleased Edward. He might no longer be strong, but he was still powerful. He smiled.
"Do you understand?"
"Yes,"
Gifford said. "I understand, Your Majesty."
"Good," Edward said. "You're dismissed." Gifford was on his feet, already nearly to the door, when Edward called after him,
"Oh! And one more thing."
Gifford froze, then turned.
"Yes, Your Majesty?"
"Jane is unaware of your condition, your
Gifford sighed heavily. "Horse curse, my horse curse."
"Yes, no one has informed her yet. I want you to be the one to tell her."
Gifford's eyes flashed with something resembling panic.
"Me?"
"She deserves to hear it from her husband,"
Edward said. As he spoke the words, he thought that this sounded like a very wise idea, a kingly idea, inspired.